Hi, everyone. It's Jivana. I just want to come on for a moment and thank our sponsor, OfferingTree. They're an all-in-one, easy-to-use, community-backed business that saves you time, energy, and money as a yoga teacher. OfferingTree allows you to create a website in less than 30 minutes. Plus, you get a discount through Accessible Yoga. Just go to offeringtree.com/accessible yoga to get your discount today. Okay, here's our episode.
Welcome to the Love of Yoga podcast. I'm your host, Anjali Rao. This podcast explores the teachings of yoga for self and collective transformation. We dive into how spirituality and philosophy can ignite social change. I share conversations with folks who are on the front lines of justice and liberatory movements, thought leaders, change makers, and healers. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Love of Yoga podcast. I'm your host, Anjali Rao. March is noted as the Women's History Month. And in honor of that observance, I wanted to share some insight into women, gender, and yoga history. This is a huge topic. The history of yoga goes back to 3,500 to 4,000 years. So I will go into a few specific questions. But before that, I wanted to share my own personal story of how I got interested in this topic. It started with an Instagram post from a very popular and well-respected yoga teacher who said that it was the West that democratized yoga in some way by making it okay for women to practice. In other words, superstitions and traditions kept ancient women from practicing yoga. And until the 20th century, he said, yoga was mainly practiced and taught by men. Now that made me think, is that true? Was it the West that liberated women from practicing and teaching yoga? Are there women and non-binary practitioners and teachers in yoga history? And if they're a part of yoga history, why don't we know of them? And if they're not a part of yoga history, why not? There are four big reasons why we have not heard of many ancient yoginis or rishikas, ancient femme, non-binary women in yoga history. And I would like to unpack what these four are and also share some highlights of each yoga history period as it relates to gender. The first being patriarchy. Patriarchy operating as a part of the caste system. Second, legitimacy for the written word. Third, a colonized rendering of history. Fourth, productiveness of yoga as asana. Let's look at the first one, patriarchy. In a land where goddess worship is traced back more than 5,000 years, and even to this day is worshipped with great reverence, bhakti, where are the women, the femme, in the lineage and traditions of yoga? This is a big question. In order to look at this big question, we also need to come to a shared understanding that yoga is not only asana, but also multidimensional systems of knowledge and explorations in the nature of consciousness, liberation, and transcendence. This question will need hours to get into the complexities of gender because A, gender as a social construct exists on a spectrum. B, the expansiveness of the teachings of yoga itself, because yoga of the Upanishads, Vedanta, is very different from the yoga of the Tantra, Buddhist, Jaina, and the Hatha traditions, which is different from the yoga of Patanjali. I thought it will be useful to share why women and gender expansive folks and teachers are not as well known or regarded as influential as their cis men counterparts. So let's look at the first reason, patriarchy. As a system, patriarchy sets in as migrant nomadic groups settle into land ownership, agriculture, and cultivation of crops. The pervasiveness of patriarchy was and continues to be the most important and almost invisible factor that shapes all the realms and in all social, cultural, economic, spiritual dimensions. 3,500 years ago, the Vedic people, the people who composed the Vedas, the earliest compositions of yoga, bring in early Vedic Sanskrit and establish the Varna Jati system, or more known as the caste system, a social stratification of people based on occupation, class, and clan, which progressively becomes more rigid. For more on the caste system and its manifestations, please refer to my two previous conversations with Thenmuri Soundararajan and Prachi Patankar. During the Vedic period, the Brahmins, the scholars or the priests, conduct sacrificial rituals, yagnas. The women who are born into the Brahmin Varna are necessary to be a part of the rituals, but it is their husbands or fathers who are the primary tradition and lineage holders. Even though some of the hymns in the Rig Veda, the most ancient Veda, have been attributed to Brahmavadinis and Rishikas or sages, such as Gargi, Maitreyi, Lopamudra, who are revered as learned sages in their own right. Their mentions are footnotes, notable mentions, buried in the magnum opuses of the Vedas. They are in relationship to the men as wives or daughters of sages. They're not the focus of the text. In the Vedas are references and allusions made to queer identities in the deities. For example, Agni, the deity of fire, is sometimes portrayed as having a relationship with Soma, a deity of the moon. It is during this time that Sanskrit emerges as the language of the elite few, and that means the Brahmins, the scholars or the priests, and Kshatriyas, the warriors. The local or the vernacular languages remain as a part of oral traditions, often matrilineal and or matriarchal in origin. They are not written down and thus not accorded legitimacy. Thus, a vast majority of these rural traditions are dismissed as folklore. More research is being done now and needs to be amplified. So this goes back to the second reason why we don't know as many ancient women in yoga history, because legitimacy or credibility is attributed to the written word, which is the domain of the cis-het Brahmin man until the 20th century. Now, this is a vast simplification of a complex time where there were many clashes between castes for dominance. But since we are talking about gender and yoga history, the Brahminical patriarchy that emerges during this time, which is later elaborated in the Dharma Shastras, such as the Manava Dharma Shastra, or what is popularly known as the Manusmriti, remains in yoga, as descendants and students of Brahmin gurus become influential thousands of years later. Simultaneously, during this period, there were also more democratic, less ascetic traditions of the Adivasis from the diverse and unique tribes that are rural in origin rather than in the urban centers. Now, these less ascetic, more democratic, more earth-based traditions, goddess-worshipping traditions, later coalesce as Tantra. In these traditions and lineages, Shakti, the divine feminine, is revered. Women were teachers in these traditions and practiced freely.
Hi, everyone. I just want to pop in here really quick and remind you about our sponsor, Offering Tree. As yoga teachers, we are our own business managers, website designers, and producers. It's a lot. And Offering Tree offers an all-in-one platform that makes it easy to succeed while we're doing all the things. And I'd just like to say that through this partnership with the Love of Yoga podcast, Offering Tree has shown that it's committed to supporting accessibility and equity in the yoga world. Offering Tree is a public benefit corporation, and they're driven by a mission of wellness accessibility, which we share with them at Accessible Yoga. As an Offering Tree user, you'll get to join a supportive educational community, and you'll also get free webinars with top experts in wellness and entrepreneurship. And of course, you get a discount. So go to offeringtree.com/accessibleyoga to learn more and to get your discount. Okay, let's go back to the episode.
Around the 10th century onwards, the yoginis of Tantra and the Shaivite traditions made their awe-inspiring appearance, literally awe and sometimes even fright, for they were said to have siddhis, supernatural powers of flight, of seeing future and the past, of shape-shifting and morphing from one form to the other. They rejected societal norms. They were considered healers. They were powerful and dangerous. They both protected and destroyed, and even today have temples dedicated to them in India, like the Chausat Yogini Temple. Now, during the so-called classical period of yoga, when the sutras were composed by Patanjali, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, the Brahmin and the Kshatriya's woman's position was predominantly mired to the men in her life. Her spiritual and intellectual life was connected to her expressions of chastity, loyalty, and values of self-sacrifice and devotion to the husband. The term Pativrata is often used to depict her steadfast devotion to her husband. However, in the Shramanic traditions of the time, texts and monuments from the 1st to the 2nd century CE point to some agency with women. Some were prominent landowners and upadhyayis, or female religious teachers. Still, during this time, most women did not openly lead in spiritual matters. It's imperative to note that the primary audience for the sutras, the most widely used texts for students of yoga, were young boys. And one has to keep this context in mind as we study them. Most translations are by men, furthering the patriarchal lean of our understanding of philosophy. This is also not to say that the hegemony of Brahminical patriarchy was not or is not challenged. There were uprisings throughout the long and complicated 3,500 years of yoga, of folks who denounced the dominance of caste and gender. For example, the bhakti traditions and lineages are a great example of disrupting hierarchies with art, with music, with dance and sculpture that persist and thrive today. Many of them, like Akka Mahadevi's spoken words or vachanas or Mirabai's bhajans, are moving reminders of people who defied the shackles of gender relationships. In the Puranas and the great epics, Ramayana and the Mahabharata, gender is explored more elaborately. Caste is explored more elaborately. In this are stories of women as queens who challenge and defy kings and went to war, like Kaikeyi of the Ramayana. There are kings who become pregnant. A prince transforms into a trans femme dance teacher, Brahannala, in the Mahabharata. Shikhandi is a trans mask warrior in the Pandava army who helps to defeat the indefatigable Bhishma. Women in these stories are complex. They are lovers and wives, sages and seekers, goddesses and courtesans of every shade and of every varied lived experiences. These stories are chronicles that are all encompassing of the spectrum of gender. But they're all embedded in narrations composed and translated by men mostly. Even so, it is worth our time to study the Mahabharata. For instance, from several authors and from regional perspectives. In the 15th century onwards, in the Hatha Yoga corpus, such as the Hatha Yoga Pradipika and the Amrita Siddhi, for example, the practices were meant for a male yogi, as there are references to specific body parts and alignments. In some of the verses, women are referred to as impediments and distractions for the serious yogi. Women, travel, and fire should be avoided, especially for a beginner practitioner, says Swatmarama, the one who composed the Hatha Yoga Pratibhika. Remember, Hatha Yoga traditions were actually ascetic traditions. And it is deeply ironic that most of the folks today who practice some of the Hatha Yoga practices are mostly women. The third reason, going back to our reason of why we don't know enough or many ancient femme gender expansive and women practitioners, is because of the colonial narratives of Indic history. Our insight into the past stem from multiple sources. Historians source from archaeological remains, literary and textual references, art from a particular period, and more recently, we also have scientific knowledge with the development of technology for genetic extractions from fossils. Our knowledge about the past comes thus from what remains, what is preserved, what is emphasized as important by historians and their own worldviews. The colonial narratives of Indic history divided the periods into categories of religions. That is, they said, first was the Hindu period, then the Muslim period, and then the colonial period. Now, these vast generalizations overlooked the heterogeneity of belief systems and traditions that did not fall into these broad categories. The colonial renditions of Indic history were told and retold and are still used by many in the nationalistic factions today. More on this some other time. The fourth reason is reductiveness of yoga as asana and capitalism. Going back to my personal story of the popular yoga teacher who said that it was the West that democratized and liberated women to practice yoga, he was referring to asana. There is no reference, or rather very few references, to women practicing asana. He's right, to a certain extent, because I counter this. If we go into the temples of India, we see so many sculptures of women, of dancers, of apsaras, celestial femme beings, yakshis, who are in dance poses that are very similar to yoga asana. Dance and yoga asana come from the same roots, which is again a whole another podcast episode for another time. Now, we all know that yoga is not asana only, and that the story is far more complex. So to summarize, while we should highlight ancient women, femme, and gender expansive folks in yoga history, we should also understand and hold the tension that the very real presence of patriarchy of the past continues to be in the present. Hope you have enjoyed listening to this episode, sharing about gender and yoga history. I would so love to know your thoughts and responses. Please share with me and stay curious. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for listening to the Love of Yoga podcast, an offering from Accessible Yoga Association. Please support our work by becoming an ambassador or by visiting our online studio at accessibleyoga.org.